Hi, I'm Rod Wagner. It's my privilege today to be speaking with Michael Abershoff. Captain Abershoff is most notably the former commander of the Arleigh Burke-class destroyer USS Benfold, a ship that, when he assumed command at the age of 36, was one of the worst-rated vessels in the U.S. Navy. During his 2 years at the helm, he led a change in culture that unleashed the potential in the same crew to transform the Benfold into a ship ranked tops in performance while increasing retention and staff promotions. The strategies and philosophies that made it possible are the subject of his first book, the best-selling It's Your Ship. He's since written the books Get Your Ship Together and It's Our Ship. He currently advises clients in a wide range of industries on issues of leadership and performance. Captain Abershoff will be the opening keynote at the Safe Start Human Factors Conference on November 5th and 6th, just outside Nashville, Tennessee. Sir, I've been looking forward to the interview. Let's jump right in. What were your greatest leadership influences before taking command of the Benfold?
First and foremost, I had the great honor to be chosen the number two military assistant to the Secretary of Defense. His name was William Perry. And I was not in a leadership role. I was an individual contributor. And they never asked me for my advice on anything. I was kind of like, you know, I executed on what they decided on. But I would sit in every meeting in the back of the room, and I'd watch how he made decisions, and I watched how he was very respectful of people and allowed them to get their points across. And at the end of every briefing, he would summarize what he heard and ask the person if it was correct and if they wanted to correct anything of what his impression was. And after that, he would make his decision. And along the way, he treated you with respect and dignity, and people seemed to stand taller. They were respected in every interaction with him. And he didn't care what your rank was. You could be a private or you could be a general. If you had an idea how to improve something just 1%, he wanted to hear from you regardless of your rank. And I saw and was able to observe the impact that this had on people. And people respected him greatly, but people didn't fear him. And as a result, they were allowed to be open and honest, and that enabled him to make better decisions. And so sitting there watching that for 27 months had an impact on me that I would like my crew to have that same amount of respect for me. And that in order to get that, I have to respect them in return. And that I don't care what their age is or what their rank is or how long they've been in the organization. If they have an idea how to improve a process 1%, I want to hear from them. And so that's who my first and foremost role model is on how to lead and how to get the best advice and the best processes in place so that you can be successful.
You told another interviewer that you were quite nervous taking command of the Benfold. Do you believe that that nervousness was helpful for you focusing on the challenge, that it motivated you?
Absolutely. I was nervous. Not nervous, insecure is a better term. Am I doing the right thing? And is there a better way? And that insecurity caused me to always be challenging my assumptions. And as you know, accidents happen when complacency sets in. So being insecure caused me never to become complacent. And as a result, you know, that caused us to challenge every aspect of our operation. But first and foremost was safety, because what drove me at this point was not my next promotion. I never wanted to have to write the parents of any of my sailors telling them that their sons or daughters weren't coming home because we didn't give it our best. And so, I can plainly state that I was insecure, and I was every day, and that caused me not to become complacent and also to keep my crew from becoming complacent. And you know, we had one of the safest ships in the Navy as a result.
Let's say that someone this week gets pulled into managing for the first time. He or she is hired or promoted into a position as a manager for, let's say, five people. And this person asks if they can have coffee with you to ask for your advice. What would you tell this brand new manager?
Absolutely. Get to know your people and interview them and find out what motivates them and find out what they're proud of in their lives and get them to have a sense of comfort with you that, you know, you won't rip their head off if they come up with a different idea or if they do something differently. But what I would also tell a new manager is whenever I went into a new situation, I didn't change anything for the first 30 days. And instead, I would sit there and watch and listen and ask questions. But I wanted to find out what was working, and I wanted to find out what could be done better. And throughout my years in the military, and since I got out, I'd see new managers come in and say, well, this is what worked in my last job. It's going to work here, and immediately change everything right off the bat. And what that did was upset, you know, the organization and threw them off balance, and some of them would never recover. And so what worked for you in your previous job may not work for you in your new job. And so I was always very careful not to make disruptive changes until I understood the flow of the organization and what was working and why and what wasn't working and why. And in that 30 days, I asked questions, I listened, but I didn't make any judgments. And so that's what I would advise a new manager. But also during that first 30 days, you know, talk to each person and, you know, find out what their goals are and, you know, what drives them and what they're most proud of in their life, and get to show them that you're human and that you care about them. And if your people think you care about them, they will follow you into battle.
You took the time to sit down with each of the 310 crew members of the Benfold. It's a lot of time talking with people, and you admit in the book that you were maybe a little bit clumsy at it to start with. But tell me, if you would, why you did it, what you learned in the process, and what that did for the performance of the ship.
Well, I'm a stickler for learning people's names and faces. And I just think it shows people that you care about them if you can remember their name. And I was having a tough time learning people's names and faces. And I was also struggling with how to instill a sense of ownership and a sense of urgency. And I'm in the middle of the night, I'm not sleeping, I'm tossing and turning. And it hit me, I'm just going to interview them. And that way I can get to know them, and I'll remember their names and faces, and I'll look them in the eye and tell them what we're about, you know, that we're playing to win, that we're not playing to come in number two. And it's not about me. It's about all 310 of us working as a team. So that's where the idea came from. And you're right. I wasn't perfect at it at the beginning. And I didn't know exactly what I was searching for when I started it, but when I saw the results of people smiling and people looking in the eye and giving you thoughtful ideas and recommendations on how to improve, I saw what the power of these interviews were, and that emboldened me to become a better interviewer and to set people at ease and to get the most out of them.
Anybody who's in leadership or managing ends up being something of a student of human nature. What about human nature made you most nervous as the commander of the Benfold?
Well, that's a great question. I've never heard that phrased like that before. I guess when it came to my crew, I was never nervous about them because I had great confidence in them, and that I knew after we set the tone and after we set the culture that they would do the right thing. And so I can't honestly tell you that I was ever afraid of anything that they would do. But there were times when I didn't get the results I anticipated. And instead of blaming them, I'd take a deep breath and look at what I didn't do right And like, I either didn't communicate to them what my goals were. I didn't give them the training. I didn't give them the time or the resources. So if something, if I didn't get the results I was looking for, my assumption about their human nature was that they wanted to do a great job and that I was the one who failed at something. And so I've kept that with me, you know, ever since, that when something doesn't work out, I don't blame others, but instead I look inward and ask myself how I contributed to this. And so, you know, what I found, you know, about human nature is that people want to do the right thing, and that if they don't, the process is bad or the culture is bad, or you don't communicate to them, you know, what the goals are, or you don't give them the training. And so that's what I focused on constantly, was giving them the tools so that they could deliver excellence.
Was there a particular aspect of human nature that made you most optimistic in the early days of your command, whether that was reciprocity or people's naturally being attached to a mission or something else about people that, that gave you great hope that they would step up?
I used to tell my sailors, you never go wrong when you do the right thing. And what I found about their human nature was when you treat them decently and with respect, and if they feel emotionally attached to what they're doing, they'll never let you down. And so, as a result, you know, our motto was, you know, never go wrong when you do the right thing, and I'll support you. And I never reprimanded anybody if they came up a little bit short. You know, if I can get, you know, 90% out of somebody without me getting involved, just them doing it on their own, that's something to celebrate. I'm not going to berate them for not getting the final 10%. And so I was never disappointed because I knew they wanted to do a great job. But I'm hesitating because there was one time when I was severely disappointed, and it was my number one department head. A piece of equipment broke, and he didn't tell me about it for 2 weeks. And as a result, we've missed a commitment. And he didn't tell me about it because, you know, he wanted to hide it. He didn't tell me about it because he thought he could get it fixed without ever me getting involved. And as a result, we missed a very important commitment because this equipment didn't work. And so instead of blaming him for not telling me, you know, I realized I didn't have a great process in place to get across when a piece of equipment broke. And so I blamed myself, you know, for missing the commitment. But and that officer is now an admiral today, and it was my biggest disappointment. But I didn't berate him. I didn't destroy him. I viewed me as being the problem. And we put in processes in place so that if a piece of equipment broke in the future, they knew exactly what to do and what the time frame was in notifying me. And we never had a recurrence of that situation.
It's kind of a heavy burden, isn't it, to feel if there's something that falls through that it's on you as the commander?
Being captain of a ship is a heavy burden. And some people thrive on that burden, and some people crumble under it. And you could see when captains walk down the pier every morning, whether they're smiling and upbeat and enjoy the job, or whether they dread the job and they're just putting a check in the block so that they can get promoted. And I could sit there at the head of the pier and tell you which captains were enjoying their jobs and which ones weren't. And so that's our obligation, is to understand that it is a tremendous burden. I'm responsible for the lives of 310 men and women 24/7 for as long as I'm in command of that ship. And whether we're in Port San Diego and they're at home and they get involved in a drunk driving accident, I mean, ultimately I need to figure out why I missed the signs that, or what we could have done to have educated people that we want you to be just as safe off the job as you are on the job. And So, yeah, it's a heavy burden. Some people crumble under that burden. Others are invigorated by it. And I loved it. I would have done the job for free. That's how much I love that job.
The hazards off the job, most people would understand, but maybe very few would understand the hazards on the job. What are the greatest risks to life and limb on an Arleigh Burke-class destroyer?
Man, anything can go wrong from, you know, not tagging out a piece of electrical equipment when you're working on it and getting electrocuted, to not, you know, turning a valve properly and you have an oil spill. Everything we do on an Arleigh Burke-class destroyer is dangerous. In any minute of any day, somebody could get seriously injured or killed. And so that's why we have to have solid procedures in place, but also we have to have a solid commitment on the part of the crew to adhere to those procedures. And you can't order excellence and you can't order safety. It's part of a culture that you create. And so that's one of the things I'll be talking about at the conference is, you know, you can have the best procedures in the world, but if your people aren't disciplined and if they aren't connected to their work, then that's when accidents happen. And all the procedures, the best procedures in the world aren't going to save you from that.
Your command strategy for keeping people safe, was it a separate area of focus, or was it just part of an overall integrated plan for the ship?
Part of every minute of every day, focus on safety. When I'm walking down the passageway, you know, we have damage control equipment in our passageways. Like if we have a fire, we have to put it out ourselves. We can't call the fire department. So we have fire suppression equipment that needs to be maintained periodically, say every month, and there's a safety tag on every piece of equipment where the maintenance person has to sign his or her name and put the date that they did the maintenance. And when I'm walking down the passageway, one, I'm looking for trash, and if I see trash on the deck, I'm going to pick it up because that's part of a culture as well. There's no such thing as a dirty good ship. And I'm sure you've seen work environments where equipment is astray and tools are astray. To me, that means a lack of discipline and a lack of adherence to procedures. So, you know, everything I'm doing, I'm multitasking. I'm looking for, you know, trash. I'm checking safety tags, making sure the maintenance's done. And all the while, everybody's watching me do this. And they know that if it's important to me, it better be important to them. So we're the ones who set the tone for the organization. And so safety to me is, you know, gee, I'm not going to set aside from 4 o'clock to 5 o'clock this afternoon to focus on safety. It's from the time I get up in the morning until the time I go to bed at night, I'm focused on safety.
It's clear from your first book, It's Your Ship, that you believe an empowered crew member is higher performing. Is he or she also safer?
Yes, because if you're empowered, you're also more engaged, and you also take a greater sense of ownership. And when you feel ownership of something, you want to adhere to the standards, not only to get the best performance, but also be the safest that you can.
What's your philosophy about sleep and performance? Particularly, are there decisions that a commander can make or something about his or her leadership style that ensures the crew is rested enough to perform well and perform safely?
Well, you're well briefed. So part of the culture of the surface Navy is that we don't need sleep. And when we're at sea, it's a 24/7 operation. And typically you stand watch hours on, 12 hours off. Well, if you stand the midnight to 6 in the morning, the way it used to be in the Navy is that you would be expected to work your full work day starting at 7:30, you know, 4:30. And then it's time for you to go back on watch from 6 p.m. to midnight again. And that's ludicrous. You weren't allowed to sleep and get caught up. And so I changed the rotation on the ship so that if you're tired and if it's during your work day, you know, go get some sleep. I'm not going to be monitoring, you know, who's sleeping during the day. If you're tired, do it. Because you're no good to me if you're dead on your feet. And we were the only ship at the time that did that. And now, I don't know if you remember the two collisions of the ships in the Western Pacific a couple of years ago.
Oh, yeah.
But sleep patterns had a lot to do with it. These young men and women were working 80, 90 hours a week and then expected to stand watch on top of that. And sleep deprivation contributed to that. So now the Navy has gone to, they call it a circadian watch routine, where we were always, you know, every day you would be standing watch at different time periods. Now it's set so that you can get into a sleep cycle. My nephew just got back from a 7-month deployment to the Middle East, and his watch was from from 2 in the morning until 6 in the morning, and then again in the afternoon, and he would have 8 hours off between each shift so that they could get sleep and be well rested. And so the Navy has finally acknowledged the fact that sleep deprivation leads to an increase in accidents. And I could have told them that 20 years ago, because we modified our work routine so that if people did suffer from sleep deprivation, they could go to sleep. It's not rocket science.
I had the opportunity 4 years ago to spend some time on the Virginia-class attack submarine USS California. Had the chance to meet and interview its commander at the time, Eric Sager. And here's something he told me. I want to get your reaction to it. He said, "The most fascinating part of this job is the human interaction. The components of the submarine are predictable because they're technology. When there's a problem with a person, you don't know how they'll react because you don't know what's inside that person. Most of my conversations with my officers are about the men, not the submarine." I'm curious, was this your experience on the Benfold, and how would you add to or alter his observation?
That's a very perceptive observation on his part, because it's true. The equipment, you know, we have statistics on, you know, failure between maintenances and whatnot. And so, I mean, we've got all those statistics, but it's how the people who man it and operate it bring it to life, that's the thing that can be influenced. And that's where the culture comes in. And it's called the command climate in the Navy. And the captain of the ship or the submarine is the one who sets that climate. So that was a very perceptive observation on his part.
One of the things that struck me when I spent some time on the California was the obsession with ice cream. It turned out that they had been in Norway recently and had filled up the boat with supplies and ran out of room, as sometimes happens on a submarine. They had to leave some of the apparently really good Norwegian ice cream on the dock. And I ask about this because on land it's just ice cream. But on the submarine, it was something of an obsession. And the crew members said, well, when you're underwater for 3 months and away from everybody, little things take on big meaning. Was there anything on the Benfold that became kind of an interesting obsession that turned out to be a really big deal about something that the crew members valued and was important for you to pay attention to as the commander?
So that's a great question. For me, it was chocolate chip cookies. And we had fresh baked chocolate chip cookies every day. But being at sea in a steel tube for long periods of time gets very monotonous. And when monotony sets in, complacency sets in. And so I was very careful to understand the mood of the crew, and if we were doing something that was monotonous, to break it up and have fun. Like I would have, you know, Thursday afternoon sunset jazz and cigars on the flight deck. And so, you know, every late Thursday afternoon we could go out and everybody's out there smoking a cigar, watching the sunset, listening to the jazz. Every other Friday night, you know, we had happy hour. No ship had ever had happy hour before. And of course, I can't serve alcohol, but we could serve, you know, everything that goes into a happy hour, you know, chicken wings, steamship around, you know, shrimp, you know, and we bought a karaoke machine. And so we would sing karaoke. And so these are all the things, and that's what that captain was referring to with the ice cream is, how do you break up the monotony when you're doing the same thing over and over again every day? Because that's when accidents happen. And that's what we tried to do on the ship was to break things up and relieve the monotony.
Are there people still in the Navy that would look on that and say, you know, it's the Navy, it's not a cruise ship. And you know, what kind of an operation are you running if you're cutting loose and having all this relaxation and a happy hour? Are there people who frown on that, and why would they be getting it wrong?
So we got featured in Fast Company magazine in 1999, and it started an internal mini war among the senior admirals in the Navy, and 50% of them were with me and 50% of them were against me. And over the years, the 50% who were against me have come around. Well, mostly they retired and replaced by, you know, people who had come up through the ranks and were now starting to experience this and the benefits that could be gained by doing these things. And so now I bet you just about every ship in the Navy, every organization in the Navy has these type of things to have fun, but mostly to break up the monotony so that you remain sharp when you're on patrol. And so I would bet you 90% of the Navy today is with me, whereas back 20 years ago, I was on a lonely island and doing it alone for the most part. And when people saw the results, they realized we do need to change the way we operate.
You're a big believer in incremental improvements. What's behind that belief?
You know what? People who swing for the fences strike out a lot. And in our line of work, we can't strike out. We have to be right 100% of the time. And so if you give me a ship of people who hit singles every time they come up to bat, I'm going to take that team to the World Series. And so people come in and say, oh, I'm going to change this organization. Well, the Navy's 320,000 people, and the best of leaders out there in business today can't change that big an organization. So you focus on your own little piece of it. And so that's what I tried to do, is to focus on my own little piece of it. And I can't change the rest of the Navy, but I can instill a culture on my own little piece that challenges every process and every procedure and every custom and every tradition. And to be intellectually curious and ask ourselves, is there a better way to get this done? And our goal was to improve 1% a day, and to be 1% better today than we were yesterday, 1% better tomorrow than we are today. And creating a culture where people are intellectually curious is, to me, the way to go. And so, you know, I didn't try to change any other ship. I didn't try to change, you know, the rest of the Navy, because I probably would have failed miserably and, you know, not gotten results. So you focus on what you can. And so, you know, that's what people should realize is, you know, stop complaining about the rest of the organization and make our own little piece of it the safest and the best that we can.
There's two aspects of a leader's decision. One is what he or she directs. The other is the intention behind the decision. How important do you believe is the core intentions, or I suppose you could say the sincerity of the decision?
So I think if you asked every member of that crew, they would say that I did not do things for self-promotion, but I did things because they were the right way to do it. And so you can see you know, leaders who, you know, they're just doing it, you know, to make themselves look good. Whereas everything we did was designed to get the best results. And when those results came in, I gave the crew credit for everything, because at the end of the day, they were the ones that delivered the excellence. And so they knew that everything that we did was done with the purpose to improve safety, to improve combat readiness, and it wasn't done to make me look good to the brass.
You're in an interesting, relatively unique position, having gone from the military to the commercial world. What do you think that business could learn from the U.S. Navy?
That's a great question. And what most people don't realize in the civilian world is, you know, I've got a budget that I have to live with, and I've got multiple budgets. I've got a fuel budget. I've got a food budget. I've got a maintenance budget. So I've got a training budget. So people think, oh, you don't have, you know, the pressures that we have in the civilian world. Yes, I do have those same pressures. And I have the pressure of being in a dangerous profession where people could get killed or injured, you know, anytime. What people in the civilian world when they realize by reading the book, is how similar our businesses are, in that the people are the number one asset. And a lot of people give lip service to that, but at the end of the day, you know, we have 300 ships in the U.S. Navy, roughly, give or take. And every ship, you know, the same operating procedures, same budget constraints, same operational requirements, but yet some are performing near the top and others are performing near the bottom. And it all comes down to the people aspect and how engaged they are and the ownership that they take. And so that is the big similarity in any organization, whether you're a nonprofit, whether you're in government, whether you're in the private sector, is your people are the thing that separates you from every competitor you have in your space.
Let me ask the converse. What could the U.S. Navy learn from how commercial businesses are run?
That's another great question that nobody's ever asked me before. And I would think that the speed by which decisions are made, like when I'm at sea, when I'm in the, you know, say I'm in the Persian Gulf, I can make decisions automatically when it comes to operational things. I can see a situation developing, and I can take action without having to ask for permission to do it. But when we're not, you know, forward deployed and not operational, then we revert back to the bureaucracy, and things grind slowly when you're dealing with a big bureaucracy. And so what the Navy could learn is how to minimize the bureaucratic processes that don't improve our ability to defend ourselves. And because ultimately that slows things down, in the speed of which decisions are made back in the United States grind very slowly. Whereas I'm finding in most organizations, you know, decisions can be made much more rapidly than what we do in the military today.
Not a lot of former Navy commanders sit down to write a book. What did you learn about yourself when you sat down to write that first book, It's Your Ship?
That's a good question. So the first writing of it, I used it to settle scores with the people who I did not think put their people first and who were in it for their own self-promotion. So I did the first writing of it, and then I put it aside for a month and didn't look at it. And then I came back to it a month later and I said, no, I'm better than that. I'm not going to settle scores. I'm not going to be that mean and petty. So there was a fair amount of score settling in the first draft, but once I thought about it you know, for a long time, I said, you know, that's not the purpose of this book. And what is interesting is, you know, the book has now been out 17 years, and there's not one thing in that book that I'm embarrassed about. But if I had gone with the first draft, I would have been embarrassed about it.
So the advice is maybe write and then set it aside and then come back to it. Calm down.
Exactly. Okay. If you're upset in trying to settle a score, set it down and then come back to it. And that has worked well for me. I never sent an email or an operational message when I was upset. When I was captain of the ship, I'd put it in my in basket. I'd let it sit there for 2 days. And if I still felt the same way after 2 days, then I would send it. But if I felt differently, I would word it differently. But never send anything off when you're emotional or when you're upset.
Did the writing come easily because you were settling scores on that first draft?
So the way I wrote it is I talked into a tape recorder. And I can't type very well. So I hired transcriber to transcribe it for me. So I had, you know, the 10 chapters laid out in my mind, and then I populated each chapter with stories and love. And so that's how I did it. And then it was just a process of going back and reflecting on the actual lessons that I learned along the way and what I learned about people along the way. And so that's how the book came about, was just constant reflection on what we did and what the results were and how it can be applied elsewhere.
You've written It's Your Ship. You've written Get Your Ship Together. It's Our Ship. You've written What I Learned at the Naval Academy. Is there another book in the works?
I've got a consulting group now. And I'll be honest, everything I know I've put in those books and in those writings. And so I'm not going to write another book if I don't learn anything else. But what I'm learning, I've got a consulting group that is doing phenomenal work and getting a lot of change. And so a future book, it's probably 4 or 5 years down the road, is what I've learned from the consulting business and bringing leadership to organizations around the world.
You write at the end of It's Your Ship about untapped potential. How deep do you believe is that reserve of energy in most organizations?
It's huge. I still don't think I uncovered all the potential on our ship. And what I've learned in the 19 years since I got out of the Navy is, I mentor a lot of people now. And I've never done, in the last 19 years, I've never done anything for myself. But if I can help somebody else, you know, put them in a position so that they can get a job, so that they could be successful, all people need is the opportunity. And I think you can uncover tremendous potential. And what William Perry gave to me was that opportunity that unleashed my potential. And so what I'm focused on now is helping and mentoring others so that they can be put in position so that they can untap their potential. Every organization I see things that could be done differently or better to unleash that potential. And that's where the satisfaction comes from, is making a difference.
And one final question. What do you want your personal legacy to be?
So it's just now coming into view. And in the Navy, we have roughly, you know, 300 ships. And for those 300 ships, we have roughly 70 admirals. And so statistically, every 4 ships will produce 1 admiral. Well, my second in command is a 2-star admiral today. He's president of the Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, our most prestigious 2-star job in the Navy. My one department head is now commander of the Abraham Lincoln Aircraft Carrier Battle Group, and they just got sent to the Persian Gulf. And several of my division officers are about to be selected for admiral. And so historically, in an organization where 4 ships produce 1 admiral, that one ship has produced many admirals. And it's taken me 19 years to figure out what I wanted my legacy to be. And it wasn't the medals and the awards and the promotions. It was seeing, untapping that potential among my officers and crew so that they could go on and do better things as a result. And so I think that's what I want my legacy to be, is putting people in a position to unleash their potential and deliver greatness.
Captain Michael Abershoff, it has been an honor and a pleasure. Thank you so much for your time, and I look forward to seeing you at the Safe Start Human Factors Conference in November.
I'm looking forward to it as well, and thanks for your time, Rod.
Thank you.